I thought it'd be appropriate to read a little Wendell Berry, St. Wendell, just to get us started, and then I'll introduce my friend Luke here. And this is his collected poems from The Broken Ground from 1964. It's called The Wild. It seems to be a theme from even from last night. It says, "In the empty lot, a place not natural but wild, among the trash of human absence, the sloth and shamble of the city's seasons, a few old locusts bloom. A few wood birds fly and sing in the new foliage, warblers and tanagers, birds wild as leaves, and a million each one would be rare, new to the eyes. A man couldn't make a habit of such color, such flight and singing. But they're the habit of this wasted place. In them the ground is wise. They are its remembrance of what it is." I met Luke in 1999, I believe, in New York City. I was new to the city within that year and stumbled into his small group with Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and we hit it off immediately. He had just finished your degree at New York Academy in painting. He's a native of North Carolina, correct?
Or, I was born in North Carolina, grew up in Augusta.
Okay. So he's a true Southerner, like many of you, I'm sure. And he went to Indiana University. So he's kind of that mix of a Southerner that went north and got his education. But that's okay. But so he's a Hoosier, and he, again, went to the New York Academy for painting. Lived in New York City for about 10 years, wasn't it? And married his wife, Renee, before they moved to New York after college, and while they were in New York, they had Boyd, who I can remember them housing him as an infant and a small child in the closet in their apartment, because that's what you did, because that's what, how you made room for living in an urban setting. And he painted for a number of years before moving to Waynesville, just west of here, a couple hours, North Carolina, and has continued painting. And he is now added to his brood. He now has four kids, so it's Boyd, Charlotte, Calvin, and Margaret that he and Renee are raising, and he's continued to do his painting. And some of his recent happenings are, was about 4 or 5 years ago?
With the Prince? 2005.
2005, the Prince of Wales became aware of him for all the media's enhancing of the Prince of Wales foibles. He has a very valuable thing that he does, which he, when he visits a country, he likes to take an artist with him to paint his travels, to paint his... And so Luke was blessed to have the favor of the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, and accompanied him on his U.S. visit and did a series of paintings there, and has continued to paint. And recently... I'm trying to think of anything outside, just that would be it, I guess, for this point.
I guess that's it.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. But I really like Luke. Luke was probably, Luke was my best friend in the city. He and I really would go at it about abstract expressionism and other things. And I really enjoy it. So I'm looking forward to hearing him. He's going to talk for about 30 minutes. So let's welcome up Luke Alsbrook.
Thanks, Kirk. I just want to say Kirk's a great friend. I love Kirk. And I want to testify that he's a true friend of the arts. Long before he had a formal mission to minister in the arts, he would brave the G train in New York City, which actually doesn't even come into Manhattan, go all the way to the Riverside to the warehouses. He was one of the few people to come out there and visit me in my studio out there. So that I remember that about him. That meant a lot to me that he took the time to do that. I listened to Kirk's lecture that he gave in October on beauty, and he noted Thomas Aquinas, correct me, Kirk, and he defined art beauty as having three things. One is wholeness or completeness. Two is harmony. And the third one, which was like, wow, it was like a like a nice surprise almost, was brightness. So it was almost unexpected. But for an artist, brightness or light, of course, is for visual arts, it's you know, indispensable. That's the means of the medium, is light. So I'm going to kind of run with that a little bit. And I want to start with a little story about light from C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce. C.S. Lewis is kind of my hero. Nobody's allowed to like him more than me. But anyways, the story is there's an artist who's died, and he's a ghost, and he visits heaven, and he meets an old friend of his who's also an artist, who's a spirit, citizen of heaven. And the thing is, when this ghost comes to heaven, he is the beauty and the light of heaven have no effect on him. He's lost his ability to appreciate it, to wonder at it, to enjoy it. All he wants to know is, you know, are there any famous artists in heaven? Can I meet Monet? You know, is my work still talked about on earth? We need to start a manifesto. We got to start an art group. That's all he's interested in. So he's lost the capacity to enjoy beauty in front of him. So the spirit is trying to awaken him, reawaken him to that love and get him to stay in heaven. So can you, the first quote, please? This is the only quote I'll inflict on you guys tonight or this morning. So it says, light itself was your first love. You loved paint only as a means of telling about light. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to love of the telling. Till down in deep hell, they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they have to say about him. Now, I read this probably 20 years ago when I was in college. And it's become a cornerstone of what I feel about art and what I try and keep on track about in art. And the part that's, you know, most important, I feel, is that the person is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to love the telling. So almost losing that first true delight of something outside yourself, glorifying in something outside yourself, and having the focus get more and more on you, right? And that's a common, that's human nature. But it in painting, that can affect everything. But in painting, it's so important to keep your focus outward, to keep glorifying something outside yourself. So I'll strive to do that the rest of my career. And for me personally, the way I've tried to do that is my work kind of starts with studies from life, usually they're landscape studies, and just painting things that are beautiful, painting things that I love, painting things that impact me when I see them, and then I let my artwork grow out of that. So just to give you a real clear example, this was when I got to teach in Italy for a semester, and this was a cathedral at night right outside where I lived. And the next slide, please. And this is a little sunset study I did at the same time. You're seeing these giant. These are just little painting studies. I'm just painting these. And then in the back of my head, there's always thoughts percolating. And these start to give form to some of the ideas that I have. So next slide. And also, anytime you want to interrupt, ask me a question. This idea for painting started to develop. The three main elements, the tower, the sunset, and you can't see it, but it's a little merry-go-round that my newborn son, he was two, I guess, at the time, would play on. So next slide. So that's just a little image of this, a little drawing of the merry-go-round he played on. So next, please. It's a little study of the tower. I'm not just going to show you the finished images. I figure you guys are artists. You'd like to see some of the background stuff. All right, go on. So this is a close-up of the finished painting. And the idea was, if I can communicate it, this was my first son, and it struck me forcibly one day just watching him, just the tragedy, like he's so perfect, you know, this little boy, and just it struck me at the time of just that he would have to grow old, that he would get sick, that he would die. You know, that was like, you know, sometimes these things, the reality of it hits you. So I wanted to do a painting about that. So next, please. This is the whole painting. And so it's really a painting about the fleeting nature of life, right? So the bells are tolling, you know, the sun is setting, merry-go-round is going round and around, so that life is short and life goes by. That was the idea for the painting. But I started with this because it's a real clear example of how I like to work. I'm painting from life. I have ideas in my head, artistic ideas or ideas about life, and the paintings from life, you know, hopefully they start to give form to some of the, they give me a form to paint about those things. Okay. About the same time, paintings happen different ways. Sometimes the idea develops over a long time. This was really fast. My grandfather died at the same time. It was right after 9/11. And I just wanted to do a painting about him and that generation. And I did this sketch probably, this is really small. I just did a few minutes and the painting was done. You know, sometimes that just happens. The painting just happens. All right, next. So this is a close-up. I'll show the close-up first, then the large. And this is it's a made-up landscape just from, you know, it's a classic southern pond. It's got the dam and the backwater. All right, go on. So that's the whole painting. And this is just a little under life size, I'd say, for the painting. And I like the idea of him looking off to the right at this kind of cove, which becomes just a little bit surrealistic. Yeah. Definitely, when I was painting this, I was thinking about his approaching death, or, you know.
Where was your grandfather from?
He was North Carolina. He was a farmer, in Clayton, North Carolina. Okay. Most of my paintings, the way I make my living, I'm just making paintings and I'm sending them out to galleries that represent me, as some of you know, how that works. But occasionally I get commissions, which I personally really like because they get you to do things that you would never do yourself. So it's like, this was, they wanted me to paint the county courthouse, kind of where I'm from. So I went down there and, you know, paint a courthouse. That's about as unartistic as you can imagine. But I got down there and it was really interesting. That's the courthouse. And then there was this thing in the middle. It was almost looks like an old graveyard or something. I'm not sure what it was, with a tree growing out of the middle. And then to the left, that building was the old jailhouse. And I especially was attracted to, the porch, this little porch, the profile that faced the sun. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of something about Hopper or something. Yeah. But so next, this is that. I just did a quick color study that morning of just the morning light, you know, blasting on the side of that building.
Is this plein air?
Yeah, this is all, most of these will be plein air. I'm staying here doing that. All right, next. Did a little, just a little compositional study, okay? And this one, you guys get to see the progression of the painting. Go back one.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. Usually the way I'll start a painting, draw on charcoal, and then go over it in ink, wipe away the charcoal. So that's this stage. Next. This is laying down a shadow tone. It's kind of the keynote of what the shadow looks like in the painting. Okay? This is... building the grisaille. Grisaille is a monotone painting, so I'm just loading up white, okay? More detail, okay? This is what you call the maybe the dead color stage of the painting. Okay? That's the final painting. So,
how was the painting received by the patrons?
They liked it. Yeah, they liked it. They really did. They were like, I don't think they expected. I think they were expecting more of a tradition. Who asked the question? Who am I looking at? I think they were expecting more traditional view, but I think they really like this one. So it's hanging, so they must.
That's a good time.
Okay.
The original photo that you had, that looks like it was like two different photos.
Yeah.
What was
the? Oh, that's just my little backward way of working. When I paint, I feel it's very important that the periphery of your vision correspond to the edge of the canvas. we don't tend to do that. A lot of painters don't tend to do that nowadays because we're so conditioned by photography, which in general crops things. If you look at a Hudson River School painting, it's like, you know, that's the field. It's the periphery of your vision. So to answer your question, when I'm out here taking photos of landscape and dot, 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 and I'm piecing them together in my studio. Okay. 2 weeks out of the year, ever since I was a baby, I have gone to Topsail Beach, North Carolina. And so that's a special place to me. And I do little seascape studies there every year. This is actually not plein air. This was from a smaller painting that looks just like this. I bring it back to the studio and blow it up. Okay. It's called Clouds in the Sand. Okay? This is another one. You've seen this oversized. Okay. Oh, I got to go back to this one just for a second. This is, you get all kinds of comments. One of the worst I ever got. A little kid came up to me while I was painting this. He goes, "Will it look better when it dries?" That's what he asked me. Yeah. Anyways, go on.
I did it.
This is kind of the same thing. I did a study. I brought it back to my studio and blew it up bigger. Next slide. Next image, I should say. So that's the... And the actual painting's maybe 4 feet by 4 feet. Okay. Out of these, this is kind of still when I'm... This is when I was still in New York. Do you remember this one?
Yeah, I do.
It's kind of funny. I'm in New York City in a warehouse in Brooklyn painting, but I'm painting, you know,
beach
vacation scenes right from the beach. So this is the... This cottage here is what my family rented every summer, this cottage. So it's really a special place to me. So a lot of my paintings have to do with this setting. And I did a series of paintings based on the idea of vacation. And this was going to be the family coming in and unloading all the luggage. But the more I kept working on it, it became kind of a, it became a painting about a story of redemption or a spiritual path, path of salvation. So you start in the sweep of the painting goes up through the middle. So you start in the bottom right with the little boy. There's my son again, Boyd. He's associated with the water, just the beginning of faith, baptism, the wind. The draperies all have colors that are symbolic of Christianity. Then you move up into the middle of the painting, which is, you know, the water. No more is it birth, but it's become a load, right? He's straining over it. He's associated with a darkened window, which can be anything you want, just darkness or struggle with sin or whatever. Then you, let's do the next image, please. There's a study for the figure. Okay? And then, you know, your eyes lit up the stairway. Now that the window is opened, the wind and drapery reappear. You shoot out the dock, and of course, the horizon and the centered cloud are symbolic of divinity or eternity. So that was, and this painting is actually pretty big. It's maybe 8 feet tall. And I can tell you, if you do an 8-foot vertical painting, it probably won't sell till like after you're dead. Because nobody has a place to put an 8-foot vertical painting. It's like this, maybe. Okay. This is another, yeah.
Could we go back to that for a question?
Yeah.
In other eras, various symbols or tricks or things, there was a nomenclature that was understood.
Hmm.
As you, the artist, explain this, I get it. Without that explanation, I would have simply... seen a beach scene with the provocative pose of the figure.
Mm.
So, I guess my question is, when so much thought is going into that depth of communication,
right,
to an audience that doesn't necessarily have the hints towards what you were saying,
right,
how are you able to get your message across?
Yeah, so a few things. First, good art should be multi-layered. So if it's appreciated just as a beautiful scene of the beach, if you feel the sweep of going up the stairway and out and up to a cloud on a beautiful summer day, that's an important layer, first layer. And if you don't get beyond that, you know, some people won't, and that's fine. But art usually has layers, and embedded in that would be more layers of meaning. Mm-hmm. Now, I personally feel, well, let me just finish, just one second. I personally feel, probably unlike many today, that it's the artist's responsibility to convey clearly the meaning. So, you know, I confess, if the viewer doesn't always get all the meaning that I'm feeling it and seeing, I view that as a failure on my part to an extent. That's my struggle. I'm trying to use paint to convey in one image, you know, deep meaning or meaning that's deep to me. So that's a struggle in that you're trying to find a way to say something in a poetic way and say it clearly and say something complex and deep. It's hard to do. So I think whether this painting does it successfully or not, I guess I won't comment on that. But that's all the thoughts I have on that. Do you?
Well, and you're not, certainly I hope you're not hearing me give a negative critique.
That's no, you give all, me honest feedback. That's good.
That's not at all what I'm saying. And I think, you know, with something as simple as the allusion to the cross and the clothesline,
mm-hmm.
that would have given me a second thought, and then the colors symbolic, and just, you know, a little more thought going into it from the standpoint of the viewer.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and sometimes it is a question of time. Like, I love reading poetry, and even a Robert Frost poem, you know, you read it one time, and you keep reading it over the years, and you start to see new, more meaning in it. Mm-hmm. That's when an artist wants to happen. They want, if it's so blatant the first
right,
time,
right.
That's not it. It's not it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Following up on this, do you use the title of the painting as a clue to what you're trying to get across? And the multi-part question, do you use the bully pulpit, either exhibitions or catalogs or whatever, to give people that kind of hint? And finally, when you do that, if you do that, does the art world react favorably? In other words, do critics devalue your work because they think you're trying to preach?
Hmm. These are going to be good questions. well, historically, titles have been used to explain the pain. For instance, this one is called Vacation Baptism. I think a title can definitely help. Title can also be a crutch. It can be an excuse to say more than the painting really conveys. So while it's helpful, I wouldn't want to lean on it too much. I would want the painting to speak for itself. That would be... The art world nowadays, they would tend to major more in that. The art world, the art has to speak for its own. Don't talk about it. Don't write, have a paragraph beside explaining it, you know. But I think you tell what you think. In other times in art history, explanation was, you know, have it, tell us what all these things symbolize. And, you know, I think it was explained a lot more, and people weren't ashamed to explain about it. But, did that answer some of your question?
Yeah, very much. And I think, you know, you told me up front that was the title of that painting, then I would have looked at it
right.
at this different level.
Mm-hmm.
I could have looked at it for the rest of my life, and the religious symbolism of it never would have hit me. But
mm-hmm.
if you point me in that direction, I said, oh my God, look at all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Having been to a number of art classes and such history, it seems to me that having you here to tell us what you mean is wonderful. But I've had so many people with poetry and artwork say, this is what the artist is trying to tell you. And to me, that's rather presumptuous, because how the heck do they know? That's what they read from the work, and that's what I expect you to read from my work, is what you bring to it. You'll take away from it, because you have a point of view. You have particular glasses on. If the artist wants to tell me what he or she was thinking, I think that's wonderful, because that's the true meaning, but that doesn't mean I won't bring something to it and take something away totally different. But I don't like it when people say, this is what the artist is trying to tell you, if they're not the artist. I had real trouble with people interpreting poetry for me that way. I'm not very good at it. How the heck do you know what they were saying?
Yeah, I had a professor in college who's saying, I'm tired of having to do all the work for the artist. like having to understand what they mean and read books about it. Says that's the artist's job. They should work for me. So I, in general, this whole discussion, I feel like it needs to swing back a little bit, where the artist really does feel the burden of, hey, it's my job to convey something clearly. That's in general what I think. I'm going to quote I'll try not to quote C.S. Lewis too much, but it's another great quote from him where he says, art contains it's God's meaning is embedded in it. The reason is, if I paint a flower, I paint it faithfully. Like, I really enjoy it, and the color, the light, everything about it. Because I painted it faithfully, sought after the truth of it, other people will bring different things to that, because I'm looking at something that's true out here, and they may have things in their background or personal experiences or personal loves that they'll tap into that I don't know anything about. But that doesn't mean that it's subjective. It just means that truth is so deep and complex and broad that when you attend to it here, other people will see different sides of it or different aspects of it.
Which might come out a little bit more abstract. I like pushing Luke on this.
every painting is a Rorschach test.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should we push on?
Yeah.
Gonna go on? All right. This is another painting from that vacation series. Okay. This one, I'm going to show you more of the process that brings you all the way through. This was kind of the culmination. This is a pretty large painting, probably, 6 or 7 feet. And I, at the time, I really wanted to challenge myself to do a painting where I made up all the figures. So that was kind of the challenge of this. So next image, I'm just going to show you the stuff leading up to this. This is the first little sketch, okay? And the elements that were important to me were, the pier shooting out, and then seeing the shadow under this dock house, and then seeing through the window and out again at the ocean. And then I knew I wanted it to be right at noontime, that sunlight, bright sunlight, and some of my family walking off the pier. Okay? And so I don't know how other people's experience, but for me, when I tackle a big project, it's so easy to get overwhelmed. And you have to do one step at a time. Very simple questions, like walking over a stream on rocks. So how many figures, are they 3, are they 20? Who are they male, are they female? Where are they walking? What is the abstract design that holds them together, okay? Then I started to work more specifically. Once I had that down, I started working more specifically on the figures, what their pose would be, okay? This is the little girl in the painting. The idea of her. She doesn't do this in the end, but something about the, a young child like looking up like that, okay? This is her. All right? And then I got a little bit obsessive on getting to studies of every part of this painting. I don't ever do every painting like this, but this is studies of the feet. I just wanted to like push that some, okay? And of the hands. All right? And then I say I made up the figures. The faces, I did portrait.
That's his wife, Renee.
That is. That's my wife, okay? All right? She, go on. It's my sister, okay? My brother. It's my dad. And my brother-in-law. You can meet my whole family here. All right? And this is the final, when I pulled all that together, this is a life-size, not to scale, drawing. So I transferred the drawing from this directly to the canvas. Okay? This is a close-up. And, you know, Kirk mentioned abstraction. To me, we've had lots of discussions about this, but for my work, abstraction is not the end, but is the only means, or is the major means of the painting. So, you know, all the pieces of color here, you know, are all planned and thought out, you know, and lines that run through the figures. If you do one figure, when you do a group of figures like this, if you do one at a time, it's not going to work. You have to really start abstractly, lines that flow between the figures. So that, because you know what? That's how real life is. If you start to study life, there are lines and things running. It's almost mysterious that things group together and flow together. And it's only when we try and make things up that everything becomes really stilted and disjointed. Right. Okay? And again, you can see it really here, talking about delighting in something or enjoying the beauty of something. Definitely the beauty of those pieces of light from the background. You know, the girls here, they're just pretty much in shadow, but these pieces of light were really important to me and something I love. Okay? And then that's the finished painting again. Also, the pieces of light coming down here, you know, where that was like the icing on the cake. I waited to the very end to do that. I wanted to do that. Okay? All right. I moved to Waynesville. It's about 30 minutes west of Asheville. In 2004. And I've painted mostly the farmland. I really haven't gotten up into the wild, you know, the parkway or anything. I love the farmland. It's kind of in my past, too. My grandfather was a farmer. And this is actually the North Carolina State Test Farm, which my grandfather was a superintendent of a state test farm, so it's kind of neat. And he and my father worked on this farm in the summers. I like pathways. Mm-hmm. And when I say I like pathways, it doesn't mean I drew a pathway in a painting. It means I'm looking around, it's like, wow, I like that. I'm drawn to that. I like the splash of black and yellow color right in the middle. The line in the middle and the two pathways. Okay. And these are all plein air. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, I'm sure you do, but plein air just means you're out there working from life. This is more of the test farm, okay? This one is just from this past summer, and it's 6 or 7 feet, a little bit bigger than this, and it was done on site. So I built an easel, a big easel, based on I saw a picture of N.C. Wyeth, yeah. Andrew Wyeth's father, and I saw that easel, and I tried to copy it so I could paint outdoors big. Usually this I won't work this big on site just because it's labor intensive, but okay. This is another one. I wanted to show you this one because if you'll remember this scene, this cove finds its way into some other of my paintings. Okay, go on. And this is one of them. You can see here's the. Here's that scene in the background. I just painted them in this kind of moonlight colors. I'm just curious. Does anybody know what this is? Does anybody here know what that is? Okay, nobody here has done martial arts.
It's an Eastern code of honor and ethics.
Yeah. This was my son takes karate, and they, for their dojo, you have a dojo-kun, and it's at the end you kind of kneel and bow, and they all chant this this thing. Seek perfection, care, be faithful, blah, blah. So he wanted me to do a painting. That's another thing where the commission goes, what? He wanted me to do a painting of this and have the words up there. And so that's what I did. But it was, you know, I never would have taken that scene and painted it in those blue colors, you know? So.
Well, that raises another question if you're willing to do this. To what degree do you have a relationship with your buyers, particularly those that, you know, in second, third, or fifth, work?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah. You know, well, like, what you want as an artist, you want to have a close relationship. You know, that's, in other words, you don't want to sell a piece of work. You want to build a relationship with, you know, each client that you work for. But some people, they'll buy work, you'll never see them again. Others, you get to be really good friends with. So, but that's what you're, the closer relationship you have with your client, the better. Okay? This one, this is another study that turned into a series. And this was based on the four loves. So next image. C.S. Lewis wrote a book on the four loves. And this is, so I want to do one for each of the four loves. This is Eros, which for Lewis was not the physical aspect of romantic love alone, but it was romantic love as a whole, was Eros, romantic love. In my painting, the physical aspect of that I want to show by this, surrealistic, gown draping around the guy. It kind of had that feel. I wanted the birds, flying through the trees to give you the feel, the fleeting nature of emotions and romantic love. Also that they're face-to-face. For Lewis, romantic love was delight in the beloved, face-to-face. Friendship, side-to-side, focused on something you're both interested in. I had someone look at this and say he'd been to an African wedding, and I guess the tradition was the bride takes her gown and puts it over the guy's head. So I thought that was neat that I'd come at that independently. Okay. It's a study. It's kind of like, all right. This one is agape, or C.S. Lewis says agape. I don't know which is correct, but...
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know.
All right. Agape is charity. It's love for the unlovable, sacrificial love. And so every idea I came up for this was hokey. So guy running into a burning building, guy jumping in the water to save someone, guy bending down to a homeless person. None of those are like what we were talking about earlier. It's not poetic enough. So there's a junkyard near my house. I was walking around in it, and I thought, wow, what if you had a guy tangled up in all this junk and in a pit, and then above the pit is a seascape with a gleaming drapery fused with it, descending down, wrapping around the guy, and kind of pulling him out. And then as I was painting it, I started to think more and more about the junk the guy's tangled in, and I decided, I'm going to put in not just junk, but also all the things in life we cling to for fulfillment that fail us. So, I put music in there. I've got my easel, technology, whatever. And then at the guy's feet, there's a throne that's broken. That's almost the throne of the guy's life. That's the last thing he lets go. So that's the idea for that painting. And this is, again, this is Topsail Beach. This is taken from a study. Okay. Kirk, how are we doing on time? I'm not sure. We started late.
Yeah.
4 minutes to 11.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, about maybe another 10.
Okay.
Interaction's been good, so.
Yeah. Let's, I'm going to flip through some of these quick. Maybe the next slide. That's my wife again, next. You can see where I took that garden, that little study of the garden, and it turned into this painting. It's basically about the moment when you first fall in love. That's it. That's the test farm in the back. Okay? This, I do want to talk about this for just a second. This is not mine. This is Hopper. Reason I want to show this is because it conveys something that's important to me about abstraction and art. I've already alluded to. This work is called The Suicide. Title definitely helps here. You know it's a suicide from the title, from the bridge, the guy up there, the people watching him. In other words, what's pictured shows you a suicide. But what I think is amazing about this and all great artwork, the way the painting looks, in other words, the mode of the art, for us it's paint, for others it's music. The mode itself conveys the meaning. So in other words, just the way this thing looks, the blackness of it, the looming shape, that conveys the terror of a suicide. So to me, great art happens when the content, what's pictured, and the abstraction both convey the same thing powerfully together. And I just think that's a great, simple example of that. Okay? This is the study for this painting. So this is a lot smaller. Go on. And I wanted to show you, sometimes people ask if I work from photographs. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. One thing I do like to do is take, 15 photos like this and then draw from them. All right, next. Come up with a drawing. Okay, next. And there's the, you guys are seeing it, there's the close-up. Okay. And the final painting. And this one, I'm thinking about, this came from an experience I had, which is I went down to Georgia, I caught a fish, I'm pulling him up, and this a line of blood went down the side of the fish and dripped on the ground, which happens sometimes, but it was a little unusual. And something about that really made me start thinking about the way we're sustained. We're sustained by sacrifice, shedding of blood. I mean, it made me start thinking about Christianity and ideas that, surround Christianity. So the painting's a called Atonement. Boy, it's interesting to see how much more, they're the same size, but how much more the real painting gets across than an image. And this, there is some symbolism. Definitely, I mean, I hope that the tree, this giant tree in the center, has a feeling of power of divinity. It has three trunks, which are, referencing the Trinity. Okay. We'll skip on just a little bit here. This is a large painting. I'm very interested in the idea, just simple idea of being born, getting married, dying, stages of life. It's like the corn's cut and uncut. The idea of a community of people living this out every day for thousands of years. Like to play Our Town. That's what this painting is called. It's called Emily's Dream from Our Town. Okay? I've been doing a lot of water the last 2 or 3 years. Okay? I love the abstract things that happen with water in the foreground. Usually you just have like a plane, right? But with water, you get all kinds of really neat shapes and colors and lights happening in the foreground, okay? I'm going to zip forward just a little bit here, okay? These are all from this past summer. And it's great just to stand in the water. It's just great to stand in the water for a couple hours and paint. It's really nice.
So you're just standing in the water painting this?
Yeah.
And then do you finish back at your studio?
Right. I do blocks of time there and it kind of seeing it fill up with information. I'll take it back to the studio and work on it using photographs and studies. By trying, the more you're out there, that's the best, okay? That's from a bridge. Okay? This one is a different kind of painting. This is not a painting to sell. This is just a painting I had in my head I wanted to do about the vision of Isaiah. So Isaiah, the story quickly is, Isaiah has a vision of God in his throne. He's like, oh crap, there's God like that. And one of the seraphs, there are four seraphs traditionally. One of them takes this burning coal, flies through the air, and the commentators say at that point he would have been expecting to be obliterated by the burning coal. But instead what happens, the angel touches his lips with it, and says, you're forgiven. You've been cleansed by this. And so I thought, wow, the artist is always looking for that one little image that is symbolic of a lot, or it speaks a lot. And to me, that's Christianity. You think you're going to get judgment, touches your lips, you're forgiven. So this is the idea of the painting. Go on. It's a little closer. There's Isaiah right there. Okay. I used, the angels. That's really scary to try and paint an angel. You're in really dangerous water. But I found these images of these songbirds, which, wow, that's cool. All right, go on. And I played around with seeing what kind of colors I could get from that, just to give me ideas, okay? And so that's how I kind of came up with the idea of the angel wings. Okay. This is the whole painting, and I wish it's so hard to get this painting across. For one thing, it's really big. it's seven feet, something like that. And the text, I carved the text into the frame all around. And the text is just so cool. It's definitely a part of the whole painting from the beginning. The serifs, I mean, I didn't want them to be... I didn't want them to be wispy angels. The text says that as these angels were singing, the whole temple's shaking. So this is something you would, you know, abase yourself before. So I wanted to try and get that if I could. Okay.
Do you have the text? Does anyone have the text? Can you read it to us?
Isaiah 6. Isaiah 6, 1 through 8. Can you go back?
Yeah.
Somebody getting it?
Mm-hmm.
You want to read it?
No, I was just saying. You said not for sale. You don't have prints or anything?
I do have prints. What it's been doing, it's been going to different venues around the country. So right now it's actually at Duke University at their seminary, which is kind of cool. So I think at some point it will sell, but I'm enjoying just being able to show it at different places around.
Well, don't sell it before you make some prints that we can buy.
All right, I'll read this. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And he called to one another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for." Oh, thanks. Okay.
I'm really curious about... I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go on, that's fine.
Just these two little places in the... Like, what's going on?
Yeah, that's right. This is that same Henson Cove, that same place.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Kind of glorified.
Right.
And then... this is actually, I'm going to get this. This is a good segue for me. Thank you. This is when I went on my trip with the Prince. This is a rocky coast of California, kind of taken from a study that the temple is taken. When I was in college, I went to Italy, and I went to a temple called, I think it's Paestum. Has anybody been there by chance? It's just a giant, it's a mammoth temple out in the middle of nowhere, out in the middle of a field. And so... that was the idea for that, this giant temple with just the grass growing everywhere around it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important as an artist, you really have to feel connected to what you're painting. You have to have some touchstone of reality, at least I do, or else the power of it's not going to be in the painting. Is that what you were asking?
Yes.
And drapery is just great for artists because you can put it anywhere you want. You make it any shape you want, you know. Okay. All right, this is the last section. I'm just going to show you quickly when I went on this trip with the Prince, and we could talk about it. But these are little painting studies I did when I was on my trip with him. All right. This is that. There's that rocky coast. Okay. Now you guys are seeing these giant. These are little painting studies. Okay. And this one, what traditionally the artist, the tour artist is what he's called, takes one of the paintings or does an artwork for the Prince. So I took, he actually got all these in the end, but I took this one, okay, go on, and did this painting. So this is the Prince and his entourage, you know, touring the field there. That's all I have.
Wheels.
Oh.